I want to center our thoughts tonight around one verse of Scripture found in John the 12th chapter. The 24th verse. John 12, 24. John 12, 24 says, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit." Now, that used to be quite a puzzle to me. I never really understood that. But one thing I got out of my college career at OSU, I learned what that verse meant. Now, when I went to OSU, I didn't know what major to take, and somebody said, "Well, just, you know, take something that's down to earth," so I took soil. I was a soils major at OSU, and one of the things we learned was about crops and seeds. We had to judge seeds, judge soil, learn all about how crops grow, how plants, all about plants and everything. And one of the things I learned is the meaning of this verse. And if you want an interesting study, parallel this verse with a parable of the sower. I think it's in Mark 8, and it's the parable of the sower, about, you know, the seed that falls into the ground and dies, and the ones that don't die, and the birds come, and so forth. But if you put a corn of wheat out here in the ground, and there's no moisture, it's just dry dirt, and you put that, let's use a grain of corn, just dig a little hole and put that grain of corn in there, and if there's no moisture, it won't sprout. It'll just stay right there. Every time you dig it up, it'll be a grain of corn. It'll stay right there. It'll be a grain of corn, and you could throw it up and catch it and eat it, or you could put it in a popcorn popper and pop it and eat it that way, or you could make it any, you could eat it any way you wanted to. It's one grain of corn. If a grain of wheat falls into the ground and doesn't die, it stays a grain of wheat or a grain of corn. But if it dies, it'll bring forth much fruit. You know what it means for a grain of corn to die? What happens when you die? You give up your life, don't you? That's exactly what happens to a grain of corn. Inside that grain of corn, there's two major things, many things, but there's two major things. There's the endosperm. That's what pops when you put it in a popcorn popper. It's the white part. You know, when you next time you pop a piece, grain of popcorn, take that grain of popcorn and look at it. Back down underneath, curled all around, you can see a little brown husk. You know that? You remember that, don't you? You ever noticed popcorn before? And right in the middle of that little brown part is a little bitty hard deal that's, you know, if the grain was here, it'd be the point down here that's hard, you know, and the rest is kind of round and yellow, and this is kind of brownish and hard, right on the point. Right inside that little point is a little area that sprouts. That's the life of that grain of corn. The life is in that little tiny area right at the point. When that thing sprouts, it has to live on something. You know what it lives on? It lives on that white part. It eats up that white part just to put that root down. It eats the entire inside of that grain of corn just to live. Puts the root down. Once the root goes down, then the root can take in nutrients to put the blades up. But that grain of corn gives its life just to put that root down. Then life starts and it becomes a plant. It gives its life to do that. Then the parable of the sower, you know, the seed fell out there on top of the ground and it sprouted. Those that didn't get into the earth and sprout, the birds came and ate them. But once it laid on top of the ground and the sprouts started down, the birds wouldn't touch it. The birds have smarts. You know why? Because when they pick up the one that's sprouted, there's nothing in it. It's just a hull. They don't eat it. They won't bother. You know what we've got to do? We've got to do exactly like the corn of wheat. We've got to die to self. So we might bring forth fruit unto God. I was born in Guthrie, Oklahoma. I went to First Baptist Church now and then with my parents. And at the age of 11, a buddy nudged me in the decision service one morning at the end of the church service. They were singing Just As I Am. He said, "Jack, you'll go down front, I'll go with you." That's all he knew to tell me, what to do to become a Christian. I said, "All right, I'll go." So I went. I joined that church, but I didn't become a Christian. I lived a double life all through high school. I knew I wasn't a Christian, but I pretended. I taught a Sunday school class on Sunday. I ran around with the boys all week. We tore up Winsboro High School. We moved to Texas when I was in eighth grade. And we tore up the town. Every Saturday night, we'd drag Main Street and we'd tear up stuff. We never got caught by the police. I don't know why we didn't, because we flat tore up a lot of stuff. And I used to ride horseback a lot on Sunday afternoon with a next-door neighbor. Boy, I buddied with all through high school. A guy by the name of Travis McNair. And many times we'd go over on Sunday afternoon across town to the rodeo grounds, and on the way home we'd race cars and so forth. We both had nice horses, brand-new jumbo saddles. And that last half mile was Sandy Road there at Winsboro, Texas, where we lived, just 4 miles out of town. And many of the time, walking our horses, let them cool off, we would talk about what we were going to do in life. Neither one of us had any particular thing to do. We didn't want to farm all our life like our parents had, and they had nothing. So we couldn't figure out anything we were going to do, and we didn't want to just mill around. And so we actually thought about a few times how we would take our life. We joked about it. We didn't do anything seriously about it, but we did actually talk about it. He graduated from high school a year ahead of me, went into the Army, and I graduated a year later and went into the Navy. And I got to San Diego, California, and I thought, you know, well, I'll just forget about this problem I've got for 4 years. I'll just let the Navy do, you know, I'll just do what they say, and I won't have to worry about it. They'll provide my keep, you know, and the job and so forth, so it really won't be a problem till 4 years from now. But it really didn't turn out that way. Because, see, there was a deeper problem than that. And really, I thought that there must be some reason to live, and one thing I did not want to do in life was curse. I'd heard my dad cuss all his life, and I detested it. I couldn't stand it. I heard so much of it, and I had my stomach full of it, and that's one thing I was not going to do. But you know something? In boot camp, the more I tried to keep from cursing, the worse I got. Because all the guys in my company curse. And I tried hard. I'd even hit the wall and scar my knuckles just to let me know when I'd cuss, I'd hit something and just kept my knuckles bleeding just to remind me not to do that. But I could not help myself. It seemed like I was in quicksand. The harder I tried to get out, the deeper I went, the faster I went down. And I felt so helpless. And I knew that if I got out of this, somebody'd have to help me besides me, because I tried real hard and sank faster. So I left boot camp after 4 months and then went into sonar school, which is right across the road there in San Diego. And there in sonar school, one Friday afternoon, my job was to a cleaning station. Every Friday I had to have this do this clean down this hall, sweep down this hallway. It's only 6 feet wide. And about 100 yards long. It was a pretty good sized hallway. But I was living down, right down the middle of the hallway was a water fountain. And there were two guys down there arguing. And when I was sweeping away, and when I approached them, I could tell they were arguing about a movie. And it was a science fiction movie called When Worlds Collide. And I hadn't seen the picture. I've seen it since then, but the picture is that the whole deal is that this planet comes sailing through space, and a few scientists knew it was going to happen ahead of time. So they built them this nice rocket and put about a 20-foot-high fence around it.
in a tunnel that goes underneath and come up out by the rocket. See, they knew what was going to happen. And so the day that this thing was supposed to hit, they went out and got in their rocket, and when the people saw this planet coming, they put two and two together and saw that rocket. And they ran for the rocket to get on, because the only ones that could save get on that rocket and get away from the Earth, because the planet blasted into the Earth, and the whole mess went up in smoke. People climbed up over that fence, and they shot them off with machine guns. Those handful of scientists got off alive in that rocket. And the end of the movie was, they looked back out the porthole, and here came the planet towards the Earth. And when it hit, there was just one blinding flash and the word, "The End." What was the end of the film? And these guys had seen the movie, and they said, "What if that really?" One of them said, "What if that really happened?" They said, "Well, it won't happen." "Yeah, but what if it did?" "Yeah, but it won't." "But what if it did?" You know, and so they finally just gave up and left. And I took up the argument. "What if that really happened?" You know. "Yeah, but it won't." "Yeah, but what if it did?" You know. And gang, it may sound plumb crazy to you, but God used that to convict me of my condition. He used a science fiction movie to convict me that I really was scared to die. And for the first time in my life, I got cold chills about dying. I'd never really faced it before. So I took a weekend pass and went out to the Balboa Park there in San Diego, and I got a back road back over there away from all the people and everything, back where the farm, you know, the field animals, the antelope and all this kind, you know, need about a 14-acre spot out there to graze on. And there's just a road that goes right around the back side of the zoo, and it's right just over the fence, the edge of that road. You look down there, way down there is the Valley Highway. They built that freeway right down that valley. Used to be a big old creek, deep creek. They just filled it in, built a freeway right down that valley. It's called the Valley Highway. And the great big bridge went way up there, way high over that thing, and they call that Suicide Bridge. Many dozens of people have jumped off that bridge to their death. And I was inside of that bridge, walking up and down this road. And I determined that if I didn't find out the answer to my life by midnight that night, I was going to do something. But I didn't know what. About dusk, I walked out of that zoo, walked towards downtown San Diego, and when I got to 10th and Broadway, which is 10 blocks from the main part of town, two Marines stopped me on the corner. I was in uniform. They said, "Theta, we'd like to invite you to a youth meeting tonight." And I found out later it was Youth for Christ, meeting in the First Baptist Church just one block over at 10th and E Street. I said, "No, I don't believe I want to go." And I really didn't think that the answer was in Christianity or church. You know, I really felt like I'd give church a fair shake, and I didn't find the answer. So I felt like it was something else. I had to find out the answer, but it was something else. Well, I said, "I don't want to go." They said, "Well, come on down. We've got plenty of free food afterwards." "All right, I'll go." So I went down and walked in the place. It wasn't a big church, but it was packed wall to wall with young people like yourself. A few sailors, high school, college. I'd never seen a bunch of people like that go to religious service in my life, especially on Saturday night. I'd sit right down on the front row. There wasn't any seats left. And you know, those two Marines got up there that night and gave their testimony. They told what their life was like before they became a Christian, and they told how they became a Christian, and they told what it was like now. And they were football players at Quantico Marine Base. They had cleat marks all over them, you know, and I knew a great big burly guys, and all football players I ever saw, man, just had nothing to do with God. Man, here's two big old burly Marines, especially Marines, two big burly Marines, football players to boot, and they're up there telling what Christ means to them, and I could tell they had something that I didn't have. And it seemed like they were telling my story when they told what it was like before. And then I just listened because I wanted to find out what they found as a solution. And to my stark surprise, I had the solution all the time, but didn't realize it. Oh, I'd use it as a curse word quite a few times, but the solution was in the person by the name of Jesus Christ. I didn't accept him that night. It was about 3 weeks later, out at the base. And I asked Christ into my heart. And as soon as that happened, I know he came in because for the first time in my life, I had a tremendous desire to live. that I hadn't had before. He came into my heart that night. I went to Japan and spent 2.5 years in Japan. Just 1 week before I left Japan, I got a letter from my mother, and she said, "Jack, you remember Travis McNair, the boy that you ran around with? He came back from the Army, got discharged. He married a girl in Germany, brought her home." And in the letter, she said, "Last night, they were watching TV, still lived next door, and they were sitting there, he and his wife and his mother, sitting on the couch watching TV, and Travis got up casually and walked in the bedroom. They heard a tremendous blast. They ran in the bedroom, and he had taken a double-barrel shotgun, loaded both barrels, put it to the temple of his head, and pulled both triggers without any warning whatsoever, and severed his head off his body. I made a promise to God that day as I read that letter. I said, Lord, I have the answer for Travis, and I never made any effort to get him the answer. And today, he's probably spending eternity without God because I didn't try to give him the answer to life. You know something? Had I not found the answer, I wouldn't be here today. I believe that. So my life is not mine. I owe it all to Jesus Christ, literally." So Travis and I were very much alike. So I promised the Lord that if he would give me the courage and the strength to tell as many people what the real solution to life really is, that I'd do it. And I've had marvelous opportunities. Opportunities that you would be surprised to find different people that have thought about taking their life. And I've had opportunity to talk to them and give them the answer that Jesus Christ is the answer. And I guess I tried as hard in high school to be popular as anybody ever tried. And I talked a little about that the other night. I had a tremendous inferiority complex. I wanted to play football so bad because those were the guys that were accepted. I weighed about 95 pounds as a freshman. And I went out for football, mind you. I'm going to be one of the bunch. I went out for football. They didn't have anything anywhere near that would fit me. I put 3 pair of socks in the toe of each shoe to fit. My helmet would completely rotate on my head. I'd be running down the field straight with my helmet, you know. So I could see. And finally the coach said, "Jack, let's face it, you're just too small. They would hit me and I would bounce out there." He said, "Son," you know how coaches are, "son." "Yeah, Dad." He said, "If you ever get up to 130 pounds, you come back out for football." Finally, my senior year, I got up 135 pounds. You know what I did? I went back out for football. And by this time, I had worked hard. I learned plays. I checked out books in the library. I learned those plays. I learned the rudiments of football. I worked at it. I would run up and down the road to get in shape, and I was pretty fast. They nicknamed me Lightning. So I went out and they gave me a good uniform. It fit. And I was to start the first game. I was playing left halfback. And the last scrimmage before the first game, I'd been playing left halfback that whole afternoon. And we'd made a lot of yardage, you know, scrimmaging. And we were on fourth down and goal to goal, just 1 yard off the goal line. The coach said, "If you guys will score, we'll go in. Otherwise, we're going to stay out here about 30 more minutes. Boy, we're going to score else." So I'd been making a lot of yardage on the inside, the end run to the right. So he gave me the ball, and I headed around the right, and the guy just smelled that play coming all over the place. And that defensive safety and the halfback were there waiting for me right in that hole, and they were standing right on the goal line, shoulder to shoulder. And I went through that hole, and I saw those two guys, and I ducked my head, and just like I was going to run over them. Mouth! I literally melted to the ground. And they took me to the hospital with a broken collarbone.
and I never got to play a game. But you know, and I thought everything went down the drain because it was my effort to try to be popular.
Oh, you say, I'm not trying to be popular. You know, I'm not really proud or try to be something or be something I'm not.
Oh, yeah? When you get your yearbook from school, whose is the first picture you look at? You think I don't know? It's your own. You want to be popular? You got to die to self. Oh, we want to be something. Let me tell you about a man in the Bible that people, you know, people come and say, you think you're right and the whole world, you mean you think you're right and the whole world's wrong? I know somebody was. His name was Noah. He was right and the whole blessed world was wrong. So if anybody ever asked you, you know, do you think you could be right and the whole world wrong? You said, well, I know of one that was. Noah! See? Take heart. See, we think the crowd is right. Listen, friends, the crowd has nearly always been wrong. Nearly always. The crowd is nearly always wrong. Can 1,000 doctors be wrong wearing a certain kind of watch? Sure, they sure can. Them dumb watches can stop. You know? I know of a few disciples, a couple of disciples, and that, well, one day, Zebedee went home and said, sweetheart, don't set a plate for the boys. Well, why? What time are they coming in? They're not coming in. You know, they're boys, James and John. Well, what do you mean they're not coming in? When are they coming back? I don't think they're coming back. What are you talking about? Say, well, a man by the name of Jesus Christ walked by today and looked those boys right straight in the eye. They were down there helping me mend the nets. And he said, come on, follow me. And they got up and followed him. And from the look in their eye, I don't think they're coming back. Now, those two boys dared to be different. So did Noah. That's the topic of my sermon tonight. Isn't that some introduction? My sermon lasts about 5 minutes. Dare to be different. I dare you. I dare you to be different. We're afraid of what the crowd. Hang the crowd. The crowd's going to stand before God in judgment, and they won't be a crowd at the judgment. They'll be individuals. They can get no help from anybody when they stand before God at the judgment. There's not going to be any crowd at the judgment. They're going to be individuals at the judgment. See? They can crowd up here, but brother, there won't be any crowd there. They can get no help then. The world says, get all you can all you get, and then sit on the ledge. That's quite a philosophy of life. And just walk over people, get what you can, get your way, try to be popular, no matter who gets tromped on, and there are usually some that are. I know some sweet kids that just got tromped all over in our high school just so others could be popular. You know what it takes to be popular? You've just got to sell about a half acre of your soul to Satan to do it.
It's not worth it. It's sort of like a camel getting in a tent. You know, if a camel ever gets its nose in a tent, first thing you know, you got a camel in the tent. All a camel needs to get in your tent, just his nose. That's all. Space about that big. And then if he gets his nose in, then he starts shoving and pushing and crowding. And first thing you know, the whole camel's in the tent. See? That's how a camel, if anybody ever asks you, that's exactly how a camel gets in a tent. See, all Satan needs in your life is just a little plot to start with. He doesn't have to buy the whole works. He doesn't want to buy the whole farm. He just wants one little plot. And he'll eat you alive just standing on that one little plot. You know what the oil field companies do, what they can do? If they can get one well down in an area, you know, if there's one area that will not sell them the lease to put down a well, if they can get the lease all the way around it, they'll drill the wells this way and drain from underneath that. They'll just take it out from under them. It's sort of illegal, but they do it. That's all Satan wants, just a foothold. Just a hole in the tent. And popularity is a real key way for him to do it in your life. I dare you to be different. God is looking for guys and gals to live in their high school that will dare to be different, regardless of the cost involved. And God will never let you do things like that for him without rewarding you for it. He may not reward you immediately on the spot, but you can count on the fact that God will not let you do those things and put up with a lot of guff from a lot of people for his glory without rewarding you for it. We've tried this week to share and help you to the point that when you go back, you can be strong and stand up against that stuff that you know is right, so that you will dare to be different. And you'll have the strength and the guidance and the courage. And know there's another bunch of kids somewhere that's doing the same thing. You see, any chunk of wood can float downstream, but you try to get that chunk to go upstream, see what happens. Brother, it takes somebody, it takes some life. You've got to swim like crazy. And there may be a lot of chunks trying to push you and, you know, finally you just give up and float with everybody else. You ever wonder where streams finally end up? Just think about, you know, floating downstream. Where does it end? Where's the end of it? In the ocean. What happened to a chunk of wood in the ocean? It's just out there in the middle of nowhere. If you've ever been out in the middle of the ocean, brother, you don't see anything but water. Just water. But the amazing thing about it, the world is round. When you're out there, it looks like it's uphill every direction. It looks like you're in a hole. You look up to see the horizon. Every direction it's up, you're in a hole. I want to end with this illustration. Christ came to this earth and lived an example for you and me to follow, so that we would die to self. What he did, he died for us. He died that you and I might have life. And we need to die that we might live to him, for him. Give our life for him. When he finished his work and went back to heaven, this is a parenthetical deal, kind of like, you know, last night after the, you know, Christ was tempted. He went back to heaven and the angels all gathered around and Gabriel came up and said, Lord, did you finish the work? He said, yes, I finished the work. I completed everything I set out to do on the earth. In fact, I told them so. He said, I've finished the work. He said, I said, it is finished. They said, well, did you leave them an airplane so they could fly around the world and get the gospel out and tell them the good news? No, I didn't. I'm sorry. Well, what about a radio or TV or something that broadcasts the gospel and get it to millions? No, I didn't.
Well, sure, you left them a printing press so they could print millions of Bibles and get the gospel to around the world.
No, I didn't. Not any printing press.
Well, what did you leave them?
I left them 12 men.
12 men?
No, I take that back. 11 men. Just 11. One of them betrayed me.
For a few pieces of silver. What if they don't do the job? Then it won't get done. All I left the world was
to hear the gospel was 11.
He entrusted the entire future of the gospel with 11 guys younger than I am. The disciples were guys just a little bit older than you are. They weren't long, old, gray-headed men with long beards like most of the pictures you see. They were young guys your age. What if I picked 11 of you here and the future of the gospel of Jesus Christ lay in your hands? What would you do with it? Would the world hear about it?
Jesus was a lot younger than I was when he went to the cross. I'm 37 years old. He was just 33. You know how old Mary was when Jesus was born? Nearly all the theologians agree she was 15 years old. Isn't that amazing?
Sure. Mary was 15, younger than most of you, when Jesus was born.
I dare you to be different. For Jesus' sake. That's right.